I got my buddy Mark Johnson on the phone. Hey, Mark, how you doing?
Hey, Steve. It's good to hear your voice again, and and great to do this interview here.
Well, you know, I've been building it up and building it up, I think rightly so. And folks, just so you know, if you follow me on Facebook, which is where I do a lot of promoting, in addition to the unrealbluegrass.com website, Mark's been feeding me photos all morning. I just found out the reason you have a busy interview schedule coming up, so he's getting all these things together, and that's why the benefit inures to me, because I've had all these cool photos with the Rice brothers and Tony Rice and the very first interview that he did, and you got a busy schedule coming up, man.
I do. It's funny, it kind of all came together right when we spoke last week when you were up doing live streaming at the Grey Fox Festival. There, I got a call from the Bluegrass Unlimited folks, Linda Shaw, has arranged for an article for me here, and the writer had called me and wanted to plan it all out this week. And then, of course, another gentleman from Fretboard Journal called, and they all want photos of, you know, the day I picked up a banjo 43 years ago. So I'm having to dig through this mountain of photographs.
Oh, they're great. It's kind of
find my history of stuff here.
Well, it's got to be fun. It's got to be fun for you just to go back through all those things.
It is a little scary too. There's some pretty scary hairstyles in there. And shirts, really loud shirts too.
Well, that's all right. That's all right. Listen, we played one cut at the top of the show from the 1863 album, and that was Angeline the Baker. And I, you know, I've read the liner notes, and I understand what you're doing in that thing, with that CD, and with your partner Emery Lester. You seem to touch on history a lot, and seem to go back and try to scoop up some of that good music from that you can apply to your style now. And boy, the 1863 thing is just a great, great album out right now.
And you probably got the first copy. I'm still getting it set up over the next 72 hours to be out on CD Baby, and we're going to start running the ads. We haven't even announced it yet.
Really?
It is out.
Okay.
And it's an album that I've always wanted to do. And coming on to the sesquicentennial, that great battle year of 1863, 150 years ago, there was Chancellorsville, Gettysburg, Chickamauga, all kinds of Vicksburg. And we decided that it would be a perfect time to revisit that old music of the time. What fascinated Emery and I about that music, during the beginning of that war, you know, everybody was going to march off to this real great marching music and these great tunes and go to battle. It's all going to be over like in a week. And they all had these misconceptions about it. But as the years wore on and the body counts built up, the body toll, the death toll built up on it, those beautiful songs were more laments and played more in refrain. And Emery and I, it's not an album that's true to the way it was played back then. We've kind of taken that music and added the way Emery and I would approach it. We put our own touch on it, and which we love to do. And we came up with some new stuff. And we've added some of our old original songs in there too. And
I noticed that.
And that was a critical thing. Those two songs, actually there's four of them, that really belonged there. And we felt that this is a project that it was needed at this time. And almost an interim project between what Emery and I do. And we're real proud of it. Can't wait to get it out to everybody.
Well, I'm glad that you sent me a copy. I got it all loaded up. We can talk about that later, too, at length. And I do want, I've got a lot of your stuff loaded into the hard drive, and we can kind of bounce around, do what we want. But as I was talking to you earlier, you know, the things that I do on this show are fairly informal, and we just kind of go where it takes us. But I did want to give you the opportunity to explain your style, which you've classified and called clawgrass. Now, I will tell you this: the people that listen to this show, I believe, are fairly sophisticated and understand a lot of different things about the music in general, especially if they've stuck with me this long. They've heard a lot of great players come on and describe their approaches to banjo playing and their inspiration and what they're trying to do. And if they were listening back in May, they heard Steve Martin, that other Steve Martin, talk about he heard your music and decided that's the way he had to learn to play. But I figure we will let you talk about clawgrass and try, and we'll just go step by step through what you've arrived at and what your style is and how it got there, because I think it's fascinating.
Well, Don't let me ramble.
start at the beginning. I'll throw up a roadblock if you're...
All right, go ahead. Well, the word clawgrass was... I never set out to create a new style of playing the five-string banjo. It was never my intention. And the word clawgrass was simply the name of an album that I had done with Tony Rice and Larry Rice and his brothers and some friends from the Gainesville, Florida area back in 1992. When I moved down here in Crystal River in 1981, I was working at a power utility, and there's about 800 people in the town of Crystal River, which is about 14 miles away from Donella, where I live now. Excuse me. And five of those people were the entire Rice family. And three of those people, Mr. Rice, and then Larry Rice and Ronnie Rice, all worked out at the utility where I was working as welders and pipe fitters. And I was introduced to Larry Rice, the late Larry Rice, who became one of my closest friends back then. Tony Rice moved back in 1985 from California. And for like the next 9 years, it was just this incredible musical experience that occurred. These folks, we became very close friends. Mrs. Rice used to babysit our daughter for my wife at the time and myself while we went to work. So we knew each other in well beyond just the music. But the music in it was just fascinating. That was that year of the whole cornucopia of Rice albums that came out. Several of the bluegrass album bands came out. Yeah. The solo projects that Tony was putting out, like Cold on the Shoulder, right. Me and My Guitar, Native American. He had recorded, it was another one, Larry Rice had done an album in 1985. The thing about the Rices, you know, I was trying to teach myself to play Scruggs, too. I'm a Scruggs player also, as well as a clawhammer player. I learned both simultaneously. But back in the 70s, I first started playing from I'll back up a little bit here.
Sure,
my clawhammer playing was more rudimentary. It's called a frailing style that I learned from Jay Unger, the fiddler, up in Hudson Valley back in 1971. And he just taught me that rudimentary style, and that was it. I took 5 of 8 lessons. I got grounded for the last 3 because I'm 16 and driving my mom's car around too fast. But that was it. And then I was surrounded by a lot of people up there, and I never realized the great banjo players that were in the area. I grew up kind of poor. My dad was real sick at the time, so my world was very, right close in. So I used to make my own music up. And I would listen to, all you could really get back then was like LPs, 1 or 2 if you could even afford them. So you just make your own music up and learn your own styles. I took what Jay had taught me on the frailing style. And then I got another album called The World of Flattened Scruggs, and I wanted to learn that bluegrass style.
I have that album. Is it a double album where they're...
it was an old double album.
I've got that. Well, you mentioned that, and that picture of the album came back to me right away. By the way, Jay Unger, if we mention one song title, everybody out there will immediately know who we're talking about.
The Ashokan Farewell.
Yeah, man.
It was funny, Steve, at the time, I didn't know who he was, and I didn't know the other banjo player he brought in either. It was a guy named John Cohen from the New Law, who later found out I was from the New Lost City Ramblers. I was so new at the time, I mean. But that's what's happened. Since then, I've had this kind of series of bumping into people who I really didn't know who they were, who took an interest in what I was doing once they heard me playing. And to get back to the Rice thing, I came here, and the Rices were fascinated with clawhammer playing. And I was always embarrassed to play it because during the 70s, clawhammer was really uncool. Everybody was playing the bluegrass stuff. And into the 80s, too. Nobody wanted to hear clawhammer. It was more that flashy bluegrass stuff. And me, too. I love Scruggs.
Well, me too. Me too, Mark. So, I'm
We're fellow travelers.
Absolutely.
Anyway, long story short, I was learning both styles at the same time and bumping into people. And I guess probably one of the big lightning bolts that occurred, Tony Rice had moved back to Crystal River, and he and Larry and Wyatt rode up to my house in Dunellen, and I introduced him to my wife, and Well, Tony, Larry, inside talking with Sarah, Wyatt and I went out under the garage carport, and I said, Wyatt, let's play that Clinch Mountain Backstep by Ralph Stanley. So we're out there. Wyatt and I have been playing a lot at that point. He was learning his guitar, too. And we were playing Clinch Mountain, and Tony and Larry and Sarah came outside. And Tony comes up and he goes, Chicken Choker music. I love it. That's what he called Clawhammer playing.
I have to tell you this. I've about 60 interviews into this journey, and no one has called it Chicken Choker. That's a new
chicken
one.
Chicken Choker.
I'm going to write that one
down. He truly loved it, though. For all the years that I knew Tony Rice as a close friend and a guitar player, his greatest love was the simple sounds that he grew up with, and that's what he would tell me. So he asked Wyatt if he could see his guitar, and he goes, you're forgetting one part, the backstep, that little choke note that he put in there. And he showed me how to do that. And all of a sudden, this new relationship had started with Tony Rice.
Nice.
And we started playing together. He started inviting me over to his house, and we would play a lot of those old tunes. And this went on for many years. I mean, between Tony and Wyatt and Larry. And Ronnie was living down there, too, playing the killer bass. They were doing the Rice Brother recordings during that period of time, too. And we would get together on Friday nights over at Larry's house. And if I ever die from a lung disease, it'll be from a secondary smoke that I had to ingest at the time there. But they didn't write music, but they created music. And they would get together we would all get together on Friday nights and say, hey, listen to this, I got up with a new sound here.
Wow.
And that's how we did it. And that they taught me how to do that. But even beyond that, Tony, I'd be working a day shift, and Tony's breakfast time would be about 8 or 9 at night. That's when he's waking up. And he would invite me over, especially on weekends. And we would have just amazing musical experiences. A lot of times we wouldn't pick our instruments up. He would just play music. And he would get me to listen to things. When I first started sitting there quietly listening, when I'd start talking after a few minutes, he'd just look at me and say, psh, let's listen. Yeah. And what he was doing, he was teaching me how to listen. He's teaching me how to hear different things.
And what a gift. What a great gift. I know you probably teach and have. And isn't that the real key to all of it, is learning how to really listen?
Well, yeah. And in the very beginning, I didn't realize what was going on, but I realized very quickly. And we would listen to everything. Before the flood, it got flooded out down there in 93, but for years, he had this huge LP collection of bluegrass. And then on the top shelf and the bottom shelf was all jazz players like Miles Davis, yeah. Ornette Coleman, and we would listen to things. He put a piece on and go, now, I want you to hear this. Listen to this. And he would say, do you hear what the bass player's doing? Can you hear him breathing? Did you hear how he's just sensing his way through this one piece here? And
wow.
We would sit there and listen to things like that, listen to Miles Davis play. And I never listened to that stuff until I finally, I was like, oh, my God, this is a lot going on here.
Wow.
More than I ever sensed. And then we would get back into listening to the acoustic music, the bluegrass and oriented music, and the newgrass and the new acoustic stuff, and his dog music, all that stuff. And then he would take his guitar out and start playing a little bit. He says, pick your banjo up. And sometimes I would say, hey, I've written a new melody here. And he would be fascinated with that. There's a tune I wrote called My Friend Betty that I recorded on a Pine Castle project that unfortunately did not go anywhere. I had come down with a melanoma cancer.
Ooh.
Right when that project came out.
Okay.
The project never went anywhere, but it's on that project, and you can get it, I think, on the web.
Okay.
It's still digitally available, but his rhythm playing was just stunning. In fact, I got so used to, the only two guitar players in the whole area were Tony Rice and Wyatt Rice.
And
I used to think that was the standard.
It's a standard, but it's a really high standard.
Yeah. But there was some other great players, too. A guy named M. Kelly Sullivan and Gabe Vala out of the Gainesville area was in the area, too. Periodically, the people that came to Crystal River, that was another thing. Clay Hess, Clay Jones, I'm sorry. Let's see, somebody else. Let's see. The two albums that Norman and Norman did that here with Tony.
Sure.
I sat and witnessed those getting recorded right at his house down.
Did you really?
That's fascinating. Norman and Tony doing their thing. Just a lot of people like that would flow through. And this one on, it was just like lightning bolts hitting 1,000 times in one spot. But here's the key. When you play Clawhammer with Tony Rice, you can't just play in a, like a note brush thumb, that kind of right-hand pattern, kind of crashy sound. You're playing in duet form, so I had to figure out ways to be able to approach his music and the stuff we were playing and get out of his way and but compliment him at the same time. And I think what came of that was I went back home. He had this incredible sense of melody and timing that I wanted to create on my banjo. In order to, I wound up, in doing so, was able to learn how to play different forms of backup, like counter harmonies, counter melodies and harmonies, anything that would complement what I'm doing to really round the sound out. And I didn't realize what was happening at the time, but I had to change my whole right-hand pattern around from just a basic claw hammer and like a note brush thumb pattern to doing roll patterns. And that's where all the Strugs playing that I had learned came in, because I understood how Strugs players play in ensemble, like full bluegrass bands, much the way jazz players play.
Yeah.
And in bluegrass, a bluegrass banjo player plays rolls. They do forward rolls, backward rolls, thumb alternating. If they're doing Strugs, they're playing the chromatic runs, melodic runs. They're all kind of, backup is lead. That's one thing I learned.
Yeah.
Listening to J.D. Crowe, was backup is lead. So taking that side of my bluegrass side of my brain and applying it to what I was doing clawhammer, I was able to come up with roll patterns. Like I play three-finger clawing. And I was able to figure out how to do a forward roll in a clawhammer style, a backward roll, and everything's now alternating when you do this stuff. And reapplying all the technique, like in a bluegrass band, you have to know how to back up each instrument specifically. It's a different backup for each one, whatever instrument you're playing. And yet, everybody's working to make that one person in the microphone sound excellent. And if that means not even playing at all, you don't play.
Yeah.
So all that technique I brought into what I was doing, and just it became what I did. And I just loved doing it, and people liked hearing it, so I kept doing it over and over again. It led to an album called Clawgrass.
Yeah. I've got some of that queued up, but let me ask you one more thing, though. So the whole concept of what is now referred to almost generically I don't know that people always associate it with you, but, you know, folks, Mark Johnson is the Clawgrass guy. But so you kind of developed this in this process of listening and playing and listening with Tony and playing with Tony Rice and the Rice Brothers, and out of a need to kind of fill in other spots that you recognize from more traditional bluegrass playing. You kind of merged them both, I guess. You merged clawhammer and three finger style, and at some point you gave it a name. I guess from the first album, maybe you kind of carried that forward. But it sounds like it kind of was an organic thing that you were participating in this great experience with the Rice Brothers and sort of melded a couple of different styles to fit in those different time patterns.
That's exactly what happened. Looking back, I didn't realize. Exactly what was happening at the time. It's just that the sound was coming about and everybody would like it, especially Tony and Larry and Wyatt. They really appreciate it. And that when you get that kind of encouragement, that, you know, I had no stage experience either. That was another thing. I've never been in front of, performed live or recorded or anything. In fact, the first recording of Clawgrass was on an album that Larry Rice had invited me on with his brothers called Hurricanes and Daydreams.
Mm.
And that was in 1985, and had back then what was now the original Virginia Squires,
okay,
which was Sandy Sheeler, and in fact Markman was not on that, but had the Simpkins brothers working on it, and I think Mary Chapin Carpenter collaborated on it too.
Wow!
But I wrote a tune called "Move Along." It was the last song on the second side. Larry and Wyatt and Ronnie and myself recorded it down in WMNF Tampa. The radio station down there, we added it to the album. But then that led on to other things. And, of course, in the word Clawgrass, Tony kind of introduced me to the world and started getting a few articles little articles here and there, but when we came up with that album title, it was either going to be the word Clawgrass or Blue Hammer.
I appreciate your selection there, Mark.
It was almost a coin toss.
Well, I'm glad it landed on heads, whatever got you Clawgrass. I don't know that Blue Hammer really gets it through to me. I guess it would have, but I'm much happier with Clawgrass, so thanks for the flip of that coin, just for me aesthetically.
The owner of the studio up there at Mirror Images, which is now defunct, was Gabe Val, the guitar player, his father, Ray Val. He's a good friend. He was the one helping me bandying that thing around. And everybody says, Clawgrass, make it Clawgrass. So that's where it was. And then because the sound was so different over all the years, as it started to get attention with magazine articles, newspaper articles, and radio interviews, it was the people that were doing the magazine, the writers, and they needed to call it a style. They're the ones that hung that name on it.
Let me ask you this before we... I do want to play Clinch Mountain from that first album that we're talking about. But who was voting for Blue Hammer? I just want to know if anybody will fess up to that.
Well,
now.
We, everybody was throwing it around. We're all having a good laugh over okay. The studio there.
It was your favorite. You can admit it. It's okay. You were really pulling for Blue Hammer, weren't you?
No, I think we Clawgrass made sense, but we wanted to look at it from three dimensional, so we threw out a whole, whole lot of, Clobberhammer was even one we thought.
Say that again.
Clobberhammer.
I don't like that one at all. That's no good.
We were just kidding around. Guys could do it. In fact, the people that played on that album, other than the Rices, was a great dobro player out of Gainesville, Tuck Tucker, and a great old-time fiddler by the name of Tammy Murray, and then the other fiddler who did all the classic fiddling is the great Jason Thomas, who's out there working with Claire Lynch and all kinds of folks.
Okay. Why don't we take a break then? And if you just tuned in, we're talking to Mark Johnson on Steve Martin's Unreal Bluegrass. Mark, do you mind if I click over to that first Clawgrass-named album and play Clinch Mountain, since we were talking about Clinch Mountain backstop?
I'd love to hear it. Listen to Larry Rice's mandolin playing. Tribal.
Yes. All right, let's do that. Folks, hang on a second. We're going to play you Clinch Mountain Backstep from the Mark Johnson with the Rice Brothers and Friends, and the album is titled Clawgrass, and that's kind of where the name evolved from of Mark's style. Hold on just a second. All right, that was fun. That was Clinch Mountain Backstep. Mark and I were talking while you all were listening to that. I'm going to save that tune for later, but we were just talking about the different styles, and I happened to pick Clinch Mountain Backstep because it was an early statement of what Mark was doing with the Rice Brothers, and turns out, Mark, as we discovered in my library here, and I think I know how I got this. I have Bridging the Gap, and Mark was talking about this album earlier as a tune that he wrote on there called My Friend Betty. And I remember, Mark, I know I met you a couple times, but I met you at IBMA many, many years ago, early stages of the Louisville phase of that. And you might have given that to me then. I just can't recall, though. Does that ring a bell at all?
Well, I think that I'm sitting here going through my memory, too. And if it was at Louisville, it had to be the early, one of the first ones where it switched over from Owensboro.
Right.
Owensboro, I got the showcase down there back in 1996, I think it was, 95, 96, I think it's 95. I can't remember anymore, but I remember that album, The Bridge and the Gap, came out in 98. And it garnished me, I shared a cover on Bluegrass Unlimited with Tony Trischka and Bobby Hicks. And that was the album of the time.
Okay.
For the great Pinecastle Records folks. Really worked with me. Bill Emerson produced it.
Yeah, well, we were talking off the air that the opening tune is Welcome to New York, which is a tune that I think Bill wrote, but that's nice that Bill produced an album. That's always a good thing to do, but we're going to play a little bit later. We're going to play My Friend Betty, and we'll play whatever else you want to play, Mark. And if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Mark Johnson on Steve Martin's Unreal Bluegrass on Worldwide Bluegrass, and we're just kind of chatting, and we got a lot of time. We can talk about whatever, but Mark, okay, so now we've heard that genesis, at least where we got the title of Clawgrass from that first album, and we played Clinch Mountain. And you've got how many albums have you put out? And include you and Emery also, if you don't mind. Just a ballpark.
I think there's a total of six now, okay. With the brand new one that started with Clawgrass. And the Clawgrass album, And that led to an album called Bridging the Gap on Pinecastle Records.
Okay.
That Bill Emerson produced, and the band was Jerry Campbell out of Jacksonville, Alan Shad at the time out of Jacksonville, and Alan Watkins out of Northern Alabama. It used to be a Verdi. And we had some guest players like Pat White from the Navy Band came in. But that album, that's the one I mentioned, what didn't go anywhere, simply because I had a melanoma cancer with a little bit of complication on it. So,
okay.
The next one after that, Bill Emerson became quite a friend, a great friend, and a great guide in life. And he's the one that that got me and Emery Lester together. I remember him saying to me, "Mark, there's a mandolin player that I'm playing with who writes all kinds of music. And he's a very creative person. And I would like for you to meet him, and you will play with him."
That was an order.
He just came out of the Navy. He's used to giving orders.
Yeah, that's right.
And he said the same thing to Emery. He ordered Emery to do it, too. And we've been together now 14 years. So the next album that came after Bridging the Gap, I was pretty much... been taken by that cancer thing. My mind was a little, with my first brush with mortality kind of messed up a little bit. So Emery was great, and he had talked me into coming up to Virginia and then going down to a studio where he was recording some music of his own. I think it was an album called Cruising the Eights. And he got me down. Come check the studio. We can listen to his new album I'm doing. We get down there, and it was a trick. Because I wasn't ready to go in the studio. And we went into the studio, and we started recording a little bit. And I couldn't believe how good it sounded. And we recorded almost two-thirds of the first album we did called Acoustic Campaign that day in George Hotchkiss's Phoenix Studios in Browntown, Virginia, just south of Front Royal.
And you did not know Emery but for the introduction from Bill Emerson, you're saying?
Well, we had met. I drove up from Fredericksburg where we were doing the recording, and Emery was living on a mountaintop up in Front Royal. So we got together. It was kind of dark and had to drive up all these switchbacks to get to the top of this mountain. But we had something to eat and had some coffee, and we started playing together, and immediately we knew that we were going to be making music together. It clicked like that. And that's what led on further on down the line. It was several months after that before I was able to get up there and get into that studio the first time. And I was at the time, we're big history guys.
I can tell.
A big
and by the way, folks, if you listen to, if you find Mark's albums, you're going to get a history lesson somewhere along the line. I'll just tell you that right now, which is a good thing.
Well, it's who we are as a people. As a country, and I mean, you know the old adage that truth is stranger than fiction. Truth is what happened in our country is just fascinates us, and Emery's real caught up in the nautical end of it there, and then caught up with a lot of the, you know, the struggles that our country's had, all kinds of struggles,
yeah.
But more so probably the American Civil War period because of the Second American Revolution. Essentially.
Yeah.
So the passions that lit everybody of all creed and color in that country 150 years ago were just, they're undeniable. And it came out in music. And I would go up to Gettysburg and hang out with my friend George Wunderlich, who's the great American Civil War banjo,
sure.
Reproduction Civil War banjo guy. He's also the director of National Museum of Civil War Medicine in Frederick, Maryland. Anyway, long story short, we're in the history, we enjoy it, and we like to kind of transfer it over into our music, so we did Acoustic Campaign, and that had several tunes along those lines.
Yeah, I noticed that right away, and I've listened to your music before, but I like to read liner notes and just kind of pick around at different things, and it's not a big secret that you're definitely into the historical aspect, not just of... And folks, it's not just a history of banjo. It's a history of music, but it's not like you're going back to recreate every step in the evolution of a banjo or banjo styles. You're playing historical pieces interpreted the way that you and Emery do it, but you're not trying to go back and create the very first minstrel show or anything like that. It's different.
You're absolutely right. The one thing that we really tried to do that we found out we both can do is we put a lot of emotion to the music, a lot of we play emotively. And you'll hear that in the playing on a lot of that. there's an album on the acoustic campaign. There's a song, I'm sorry, on that album there called Mosby's Rangers that we re-released on this new 1863 just because it belonged on it. But, of course, Acoustic Campaign went out, and you know, we'd go to IBMA every year and go out and play a few shows here and there, and we both had day jobs. And we loved doing it so much that we got together again and did our second album, which is called Acoustic Rising. And that album was picked up by Mickey Gamble up there at the Crossroads Mountain Home Record Label in Asheville, North Carolina. And we were stunned what happened with that one. He wound up getting a nomination up at IBMA, a Clawhammer Banjo album, getting a nomination up
That's
at
great.
IBMA.
That's great.
And it wasn't just the Clawhammer Banjo. I mean, Harry Lester, you got to understand, this guy is just one of the most powerful musicians out there. He's multi-instrumental. Of course, he's known for his mandolin playing. He's musically terrifying on that thing sometimes. But he's a great guitar player. He's a great bass player, stand-up bass player. Some of the other instruments, great banjo player. Nobody even knows that.
Really?
He fiddles. He plays an Irish harp. He plays piano. Sings. I mean,
so you replaced the Rice Brothers with Emery.
Yes. I mean, well, they said Bill Emerson. So it was, I mean, Tony and the Rice Brothers, Tony in particular, got me started. In fact, he knew that I had no experience working in front of crowds and microphones. And when I got sick with that cancer thing, I remember he says, get in your car and get up here immediately. We're going to Merlefest. And that was in 96. And I got up there, and it was about a six-hour drive. I'm sorry. That was another visit. That was before that. There was no. I'm sorry. That was the Merlefest because we played at. He invited me to play on the hillside stage and at the midnight jam. And what he was doing was teaching me how to get up in front of crowds.
Oh, nice.
I got my mind off of all the crazy things that were going on.
Hey, Mark, we hadn't planned on talking about this, but you've several times mentioned the melanoma, and I only talk with people about what they want to talk about. And if you want to expand on that a little bit and just kind of cover that period, that's fine. If not, that's fine too. But I don't want to ignore it by not coming back to it that you've mentioned it a couple times. And honestly, I wasn't aware of it.
Well, that's okay. I mean, we all struggle with things. At that time, I caught a melanoma. I literally caught it. But it's a pretty fast cancer. It was a late stage too. And I remember I spotted it on my skin. It wasn't there like a week and a half prior to it. So went in for surgery, got it all taken care of, didn't have to go through any of the, it's a crazy cancer, it can go anywhere quickly. And but they caught it, you know.
Oh, good.
The Lord had a different plan for me, I guess. It affected my music. I mean, all of a sudden I started playing even more emotional. And that's why, going back to when I first started playing, just to write my own music and just make my own sounds, just to kind of say what I couldn't say in words. And I found myself doing that again. And the more I did it, Emery Lester is a very emotive player. So he would just pick right up on it. And our music really started molding that way, especially with the stuff that I was writing.
Did you feel like you wrote more after that? Or just the emotion became stronger?
And there was a whole cornucopia of songs that came out. After that experience, and that was actually in 96 when I found it.
Okay.
So, in fact, that tune that I do with Tony Rice, recorded on the 1998 Bridging the Gap album, My Friend Betty was a tune that, it's an interesting story on that too.
Okay. Explain that. We'll play it because we found it in the library here.
Oh, cool. Betty Beenan was a friend of Mary Dobbs up at the old Winter Hawk Bluegrass Festival.
Which is now Gray Fox. I love Mary Dobbs, by the way.
Yeah, and it was actually the Virgin Mountain Bluegrass Festival before Winter Hawk, which is an old festival I used to go to. But I got a call from her inviting me to come to Winter Hawk. to perform as a solo. I thought it was just a little side stage thing. That was pretty scary. But I remember when she was talking to me, I just found out about that whole scene and with the melanoma. And we went through the business of, you know, what it would take to get me up there. And then she, just the woman had never met me before, but over the phone she goes, "Well, I hear something in your voice, Mark. Is there something wrong?" She goes, "No." And she kept pressing. And finally I told her. And she goes, "Oh, I thought so." And "What do you mean?" She goes, "Well, I'm a survivor of cancer, too." And she told me this whole story. Oh. And she was the first person that I ever spoke to that was a survivor. And most people, you know, when you come down with something like that, you can do it, you can do it, you'll get through it. But when you talk to a survivor, it has different meaning. And I just was so amazed that this woman had spoken to me like that. She was one of the first ones who had. I wrote this melody and called My Friend Betty, and I took it to Tony, and he was just fascinated with it. And he wouldn't take a break either, but he was his. Remember we said that rhythm is lead early on in this conversation?
Right. Yeah, right.
This is his rhythm.
Okay.
Guitar playing.
Hey, you know, by the way, Phil Ledbetter was on like the day that he was cleared, literally within a couple of days of him being cleared of what he was going through. And he said that they're getting together an album sometime in Nashville of survivors.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. And he mentioned a bunch of them then that I didn't know of. And I frankly, I've forgotten all the names. But the notion was we're going to get together and do an album of survivors. And I just thought, wow, what a great project that'll be.
Yeah, that'd be a good one for sure.
Yeah.
It gives you a whole new look in life.
Oh, yeah. All right. Well, that's good. Mark Johnson, we've queued up here My Friend Betty. Let's play that, and then we'll come back and chat a little bit more. I know you got a lot going on, but let's get up to date when we come back, and then we'll see where we're heading from there, okay?
All right,
man.
Sounds good.
Hold on, bud. All right, there we were. That was My Friend Betty, and Mark and I were just chatting in the background. Took me a while to cue that one up. As I mentioned to Mark, my trip to Grey Fox necessitated me buying a mixer so that I can handle the live feed. So there might have been an extra little delay, for which I apologize, but that was the My Friend Betty tune that Mark was talking about earlier on Bridging the Gap. Beautiful. And you're right, the guitar work and your support and back and forth is just a wonderful thing, and that's a tune that you wrote.
Yeah, that was what came out of you. We were talking about playing with a lot of emotion, and that's I write tunes about people. I write a lot of music about people. I name it after people and that have affected me in life, and that's just one of them. And it was great to play with Tony. And
it's a beautiful melody. Beautiful melody.
Thank you.
You were, as we were coming back out of that break, you were mentioning that the difference between, what was the word that you used, old time versus?
Well, yeah, back in the 70s and 80s, I mentioned that, you know, there are two camps. There's the bluegrass camp and the old time camp, and they would never mingle and mix. But I was so isolated, and I was playing both styles anyway, so I just went where I went. You know, 6'4", so.
Yeah, Mark's a big guy. I've seen him in person.
And just do what I did, but I wasn't doing it, you know, arrogantly. I just didn't know. I didn't know there were rules. And
there should Mark, that brings me to a point. There shouldn't be. There really shouldn't be rules. It's one of the more frustrating things. Just give me a second to edit. You know, Grey Fox, for example, if you look at the schedule up there, they covered everything, and it should be that way. There shouldn't be plastic placards with bluegrass versus old time versus. I mean, it's all great music. It's all great American music, and to me, it's a huge tent. And
I couldn't agree with you more. I felt that way from the beginning of me ever picking up a banjo. Yeah. And I never understood why there was divisions and rules and all this weird stuff. And I used to get shunned. There's a funny story to kind of come with it. When I did Clawgrass, that album Clawgrass, the people that did the liner notes on it were Tony Rice. And I reached back out to Jay Unger. He was really shocked because after I'd seen him in 20 years and all of a sudden, I said to this, one of his students had done a thing with the Rice Brothers. He was like, oh, my God. So he wound up writing some liner notes for it. And then I reached out of the blue to a hero of mine, David Holt, and asked him if he would. He said,
yeah.
Send it up to me. So all three of them wrote liner notes on it. Well, David invited me up to Mount Airy, North Carolina, to the festival there. And so I went up and visited with him, and he was there with a film crew from the University of North Carolina. Right. They were filming the folk end of it. He says, well, I tell you, we're going to take off for a while here. Why don't you just wander around and see what you can see and play some music? So I took my banjo and I started moving around, and I saw this big jam going on down in this field. And it really sounded great. It was all kinds of people just playing along, and these fiddlers were playing along. And I think there was some singing going on, too. Might have been Hazel Dickens and Alice Gerard,
nice.
I'm not sure. But I went over and I just opened up my case and I started playing. And the only exposure I'd had was playing with Tony Rice and the Rice Brothers. So I started playing what I do. I was playing along, and all of a sudden I'd start taking leads and playing backup and playing a little loud and playing soft, playing with dynamics and stuff. People started giving me all these dirty looks. And then all of a sudden they started closing their cases up.
And oh, no.
Everybody walked away. And I go, oh, man. I go, what have I done? And people are like, well, it sounded okay, you know, and then they walked away. So I go, I have embarrassed myself. And I walked back over to where I was supposed to meet Dave a little bit later. He comes up and goes, well, you've been enjoying yourself. And I go, well, I told him what had happened. He goes, oh. And this is when I first realized I didn't play old-time music. I always thought I played old-time. David goes, he went down to the preservation end of the field.
Oh.
Those folks are preserving an American traditional sound down there. And you don't play old-time. You have your own sound. And that's probably what happened.
Oh. Poor Mark. Poor Mark Johnson. He's on the island of misfit toys in the old
days. Yeah, the island of misfit toys. So he goes, you need to get out of that other end of the field. And I ran into this band called Skeeter and the Skid Marks. Was a local band playing around the area. Great, great people. Had a lot of fun. A lot of bluegrass bands. And I just fit, I fit better in down there. That's when I first realized. I met Bob Carlin. That's the first time I met Bob Carlin, too. I'd always been a hero of mine. I remember he was talking to me. I told him what had happened. And he thought I was pulling his leg. And I go, he saw how serious I was. I really offended these people. And he goes, well, Marky, you don't play old time. You have your own sound. You don't know that.
Wow.
And I did know that, and that's when I realized. And just because I was playing clawhammer didn't mean that I was playing old time.
Yeah, you were playing a banjo without a resonator, and you thought, well, that's where I fit in.
Well, I have a different sound for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's I'm real easygoing. I don't take things to heart, and I think it's like I'm like you, Steve.
Mm-hmm.
It's all American traditional music.
Absolutely.
It's all who we are.
Absolutely.
So I wound up, that's when I could realize that I'm not in any camps, I might as well just drop my flag down right here and make up my own rules. And then, of course, people helped me along, like Nancy Nietzsche and Don and Spencer Nietzsche up at Danger Newsletter took an early interest in what was going on with me. And back in 95, they gave me a cover story on Banjo Newsletter, which I thought was pretty cool.
That's cool.
And then Nancy invited me up to the first of the Maryland Banjo Academy things in the late 90s, like 98 or something. And I was still an outcast. in fact, she had to invite me, and nobody else was going to. But that's when I met Bela and Tony Trishka, and everybody was up there. It was so much fun. Rick Barron, a Canadian banjo player, singer, too, is another guy that was he became the closest of friends up there. Let's see, who else? And it's just it just kind of built and built and built. Along those lines, people help, hearing it and wanting to help out.
Now you are now. We've talked about this before off the air, probably, but now you have a Deering. I guess they have a model just for you, correct?
Well, that it's funny you bring that up. That's another group of people that took a real interest in me early on. I think I'm going on 17 or 18 years with the Deerings. They just took me, they saw something early on. Well, I was playing with, 1996, I was with Tony Rice and the unit, with Jimmy Goodrow and Mark Schatz and Ronnie Simpkins, and we were up at Merle Fest, and that's the one where Tony had asked me to come up. He asked Sam Bush to talk to me a little bit, because Sam is a survivor, a cancer survivor, too. So Sam took me up for 45 minutes, walked me around, and had the great conversation, and he ultimately asked me to pass that on to Mark Vann from Leftover Sand, who ultimately passed away from melanoma. That's how we helped each other out. But during that visit to Merlefest, I met John Hartford, and John Hartford. I remember I was standing, we just finished up on stage at the Hillside there, and he pulled my pant leg. He reached up on the stage and said, "Hey, Mark, I found your banjo, I think. Like, just come with me." So we took a walk, and we walked over to the big tent area, and that's where Greg and Janet Deere were standing. And he introduced me to them. And he'd already spoken to them about it, and the nicest people I ever want to meet. And there was this gorgeous banjo that somebody had ordered. It was an open back, but with a deep pot.
I've noticed it's a little deeper. I'm glad you mentioned that.
Well, just a hair, not that much. David Holt plays a very deep open back pot, a deer banjo. But mine's set up more bluegrass style, only that the neck, let me go back. The first banjo was an Ivanhoe open back that I did most of the first two recordings with Emery Lester. And they gave me, some guy had ordered this thing, and then he reneged on the deal. The Deering's, sold to me for like $1,000 in an endorsement deal that used my face in ads. Yeah.
Nice.
And that's the way the Deerings were and have been ever since. They're just the most incredible people. And which led to wanting to create a banjo for me with all my specifications in it. That they presented to me in 2006, the Clawgrass model banjo that they carry in their catalog now. And it's got a speed neck on it. It's got the 06 tone ring in it, and it's made of walnut and bell bronze and a maple rim. Those are key elements for materials. But the neck is cut wider, a little wider up towards the rim there, because I play up the neck. It's a fast neck, too, and it got just incredible tone to it. And they just kind of surprised me with it. I said, "I can't afford this." And they said, "Well, give us a few bucks for it," which was like that nothing, And they said, "Go play this thing. Go play it."
So here's Mark Johnson, who can't even find a camp that won't shun him. So now you've got Deering making you a banjo. That's great.
That was the same year. Well, we're going back to which albums. We did the acoustic campaign in 03. In 06, we recorded the next album, which is Acoustic Rising, and I'd used that Ivanhoe open back that John Hartford had turned me on to. And that album went and got nominated for Instrumental on Re-Up at Ivy May. But that was also the same year they presented me with the Clawgrass banjo, and I was just stunned. And I play that to this day. But the nomination, we were stunned at that too. I mean, we never saw that coming. What's a clawhammer banjo doing? Banjo player doing getting nominated? I think I got nominated on the sheer weight of Emery Lester playing that thing,
Hey, it doesn't matter as long as you're recognized, And everybody knows. I will say this: the audience here knows who you are, and the people in the we'll say the big bluegrass tent. Everybody knows Mark Johnson is just a top flight. Not only you're a nice guy, but you're just a very creative and very intense and sensitive. I mean, I think everything you're saying today is exactly what I expected you to say, and so I'm not surprised by any of this.
Well, I still am humbled to this day about what's happened and what continues to happen. Just from that album, The Acoustic Rising, we got nominated. We got to go up to Nashville to the Grand Ole Opry and sit down. I've never been to the Grand Ole Opry before. And we're sitting down in the third row, and then Skaggs and Kentucky Thunder were behind us. There were five nominees, and they were, I thought, there's Ricky Skaggs and Kentucky Thunder. And he had done our liner notes on the album, too. And so did David Grisman, and so did the late Larry Rice on that album. Mm. They all, if they don't play Clawhammer, they love it. And but they're all great mandolin players, and they were taking their hat off to Emery Lester, too. And so we got these great liner notes. So Skaggs sitting right behind us there. And they get up, and they read it. I think we were the first one that they announced, and they show our album up on the screen, and they play the music, and everybody claps. And the albums were us, Mark Johnson, Emery Lester, Acoustic Rising. It was Ricky Skaggs and Kentucky Thunder. Jimmy Van Cleve, who was working with Vince Gill at the time, and Hunter Berry, who was working with Rhonda Vincent.
Right.
And then this other banjo project of my heroes, it was Tony Triska's double banjo spectacular. And that was the winning project.
Wow.
And I remember Rich Gage was kidding us a little bit. He slapped us on the back. He goes, "Well, boys, we lost." He goes, "But look at the bunch of losers you're sitting with up here."
What a great, you had to be. I mean, seeing your album cover up there and all these things, and you remember it. You're telling it like it just happened this morning.
It was that vivid and in my mind. So many people helped us with liner notes over the years. Skaggs, Carl Jackson on the Acoustic Campaign album. Herb Pedersen on the Bridging the Gap album.
Yeah.
It's just one thing after another.
Those are all great. Those are all great people you're talking about.
My heroes. They were heroes. Yeah. I'm a bluegrass player as well as a clawhammer player. And I just was, if I could play four-string Irish banjo, I'd do it. I love the sound of the band.
Yeah. Hey, we're talking to Mark Johnson still. Mark, you mentioned one tune that you re-released in the 1863 album. It was Mosby's Rangers. Do you mind if I play that one, then we'll come back and kind of say goodbye and let you get on about your business?
Well, sure. There's absolutely. Right. Absolutely. Mosby's Rangers.
Mosby's Rangers. Is there any backstory that you want to give this before we pull it up?
Just simple. It was it was influenced. We record up in it was now known today in National Park Service as Mosby's Confederacy in that northern part of Virginia. This is a guy that ran around northern Virginia that really never got caught, and he was just elusive and really sly and did his job. He was a cavalry chieftain on the gray side of the whole deal. It was influenced. It's a cavalry term.
Okay.
Just call it that.
All right, well, we're going to play Mosby's Rangers, and this is from the 1863, soon to be in everybody's hands, the album from Mark Johnson and Emory Lester. Let's play this one. We'll come back and chat and get you on. I know you got a lot of interviews and stuff to prepare for, so let's play this and we'll come right back. There, we had a little bit of a redo of My Friend Betty, and then I also found a tune that we actually meant to play, Mosby's Rangers, so we're still talking to Mark Johnson. Mark, I appreciate you being around and hanging on for so long. I know that you have many other things to do. We have another tune that we're going to play of yours in a minute. But tell everybody where you're going to be and what's going on, and then we'll get out of here with one more tune from one of your recordings, and then I'll give you a piece for the rest of the day.
Yeah, sounds good. First of all, I've enjoyed the conversation here with you, Steve. Good. You're a real pro. And,
thanks, man.
You're one of the best in the business, and these are easy to do. You're easy to talk with, and to be able to have an opportunity to speak to all you folks out there listening. Thanks for all your support and friendship over the years. My goodness, and that's a heartfelt from me and Emory Lester. And I guess what's coming up? The next thing that we both have day jobs. We're both still holding down our career jobs. Mine's like a like a slow motion train wreck right now between that and the music, but they love it over there too. They're real happy for me. But
I don't know why I laugh at that. That's inappropriate. Slow motion train is almost never funny, but I'm sorry that I giggled at that. But it just struck me.
Well, they know what's going on. Ever since we were on the David Letterman show, I won the award, the Steve Martin Banjo Award.
Right.
I'm the third annual winner here.
Right.
I never saw
that
coming either, and it's just been an amazing year of things that have come about that because of Steve Martin. Steve Martin has come into my life after the album that we did. I'm sorry, after the nomination, he started reaching out to me with cards and via email and inviting me up back in Christmas of 09 to his home. And we wound up becoming very close banjo friends, banjo buds. And, never realized that I used to follow him around as a kid. And back in 1975, he was a frailer. But he was just fascinated with the sound I was getting, and he flew me up to New York City for supposed to be a one day of a lesson, then a party with me as guest of honor at his house.
Wow!
Turned into 3 days, and went up, had dinner with he and his wife the first night, and we just hung out playing banjos that night, and never realized how much we had in common, The guy's just an incredible musician. And that's just one facet of the guy, of being a banjo player, but I focus on that part of it.
And he's very serious and very serious about what he's doing.
And it's absolutely pure, unadulterated love for bluegrass musicians, bluegrass fans, bluegrass music, acoustic music, banjos, bluegrass, and clawhammer.
Yeah.
It's like, and, you know, he's hanging with the Rangers, Steve Canyon Rangers, and the guy's just done so much for it. But to just to get back on track here with the discussion, I started showing him a lot of stuff, right hand stuff on how to do that, those forward back roll patterns. And it's really funny. I teach a lot. I teach kids a lot too, and it's really great when you see somebody take it and then just hit a home run with it. They just start creating their own music with the few tools that I give them, and Steve's out doing that. And we had a lot of fun here about a month and a half ago. He's like, he and the Rangers and Eve Raquel were touring down here in Florida, and he invited me out to play with him. We did this, he invited me to play, and we did two twin banjos on that tune he wrote called Me and Paul Revere.
Right.
At that song about Paul Revere's ride from the viewpoint of his horse, and we played the St. Petersburg, St. Augustine shows with the Rangers. And I know the Rangers were long back too, but God, he go out in front of those crowds, those sellout crowds, and just rocking them with that tune. It's so much fun.
You know,
I don't know what I've done to deserve that guy.
Well, Mark, let me just add this to you. You know, he was on back in the first week of May, and just I really enjoyed it. He was on for like an hour and just talking. But one thing he said is when he heard your style, he knew that's what he had to do. And that's a direct quote.
Wow. I'm so honored and humbled. I remain humble. Every time I hear things like this, it's just so humbling. Allison Brown is another great banjo player who's become a friend of mine. We actually did a recording. I wrote a tune called Wally Dog. It's about Steve Martin's dog. When I first met him, he's a yellow Labrador Retriever guy. And I'm a dog guy. And he was playing with that dog. And I says, you know, the dog laid out on the floor, and Steve laid out on the floor in the middle of the party. And I says, you know, just tell me something about this gentleman. So I called Allison up, and I says, hey, I got an idea. I want to rent your studio and pay for you to come in and record this twin banjo tune. It's going to be a birthday gift for Steve Martin. And Allison goes, well, you don't have to rent the studio, and you don't have to pay for my banjo. I want in on this.
Oh, cool.
And, we hired Todd Phillips and Jimmy Hurst to come in and record this thing. We're going to release it as a single, but gave it to Steve for his birthday that year.
Good. Okay. Wally Dog, it's called.
Wally Dog, yeah.
Right.
It's actually out there. If you go out on a guy named Mike Iverson's website, he's got it listed right there.
Okay.
And now Mike Iverson's another great clawhammer player that I know is we keep up with each other. But anyway, long story short, it's a long story that it really isn't short. It just keeps building on itself.
And, well, that's good. That's a good thing. It's a good thing.
So we're
going to
be up in the Swannanoa. We're teaching at Swannanoa next week in Asheville, North Carolina. That's my next big game. And Emory's going to be teaching there, too. And I'm looking forward to that. And we've got some good bookings next year. We're playing Winter Grass out in Seattle and Merlefest. We've been invited to Merlefest.
Do you have a website where they can catch up on this stuff too?
Right now, I have a website, but it's kind of difficult to update.
Okay.
But I'm using my Facebook, and we're announcing on the Facebook. It's just Mark Johnson Clawgrass on Facebook.
Okay.
Go ahead and friend me, folks, and come ahead on and follow the fun here.
Well, listen, I'm going to, it's funny, we were talking about Steve Martin, I knew that was going to happen. He's coming to Dayton, Ohio tomorrow evening, and I'm going to go up. I don't know if I'll get a chance to say hi, but if I do, I'm going to ask him about Wally's dog.
Wally Dog, ask him about Wally Dog.
Yeah, that's right.
that Mark and Allison do.
Yeah, he'll
laugh. I'll send you a copy of it.
Okay, cool, yeah, do that, please.
And I'll tell you, anybody that goes to see Steve Martin, Edie Brickell, and the Steep Canyon Rangers, the music is incredible, but bring a couple of extra funny bones with you. You're going to need them.
Well, Mark, I have queued up here Hotchkiss Hill, one we talked about, and then I'm going to let you, I'll play that one, and while that's playing, before we hit that one, I'll just tell you goodbye, and thanks so much for stopping by. And by the way, your interview will be up on the unrealbluegrass.com, which is a website that I use to kind of house these interviews because people want, if that's okay with you.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
And Hotchkiss Hill is about George Hotchkiss, the guy that has recorded Emory and Lester and myself for the last 10 years.
Great.
So,
all right.
Thank you so much.
Thanks,
and thank
Mark.
You, everybody. Appreciate it so much.
We'll do this again sometime.
Absolutely.
All right, man. Hotchkiss Hill. We've been talking to Mark Johnson. We're going to hear Hotchkiss Hill, and then we'll resume with the rest of whatever it is I do here on Saturdays on Steve Martin's Unreal Bluegrass. I hope you enjoyed Mark Johnson. I did. Had an absolute blast. As normal on this show, things aren't timed. We just talk until we want to. We could have talked longer. I know Mark has a lot. He's got a lot going on this week with interviews and all sorts of good stuff. And I think that was a nice chat. I enjoyed Mark so much. The tune, by the way, was Hotchkiss Hill. During one of the breaks, I accidentally replayed My Friend Betty, which was okay. It's a beautiful tune. And then we played Mosby and Rangers. But wow, I enjoyed that so much. I really, Mark, appreciate so much you being available and committing the time to do this. And I hope that everyone out there enjoyed it.